Hey everybody, my name is Jesse Collings, and I am the host of the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, a show right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. On the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, we take a deep look at individual issues and stories that are going on in the wrestling world. Each episode is about a different topic, and we take a thorough and educated look at things ranging from current booking trends to breakdowns of individual performers and angles to investigations into different fan cultures across the industry. In addition, we keep a close eye on the wrestling media, and as a professional journalist, I bring a unique perspective to how current issues in wrestling are being covered and discussed through the wrestling media. We have a revolving series of guests from across wrestling punditry joining us on each episode, and we hope that you make the choice to give us a listen on wherever you get your podcast from.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
All right, hello everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of The Good, the Bad, and the Hunky. Here I'm Fred Moreland with Tyler Fornes, and our special guest for today, Dave Meltzer, the man, the myth, the legend. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Hey, great to be here.
Dave, earlier this week, I published the Voices of Wrestling staff poll, I should say, for the best matches of WrestleMania weekend with Chris Hero and Shinsuke Akatsuki taking top match. I'm definitely not vamping as I try to scroll to the right part of it. Actually, I finished second. I messed that up. Blue Panther and Ultimo Guerrero at the CML show took first. Second was Hero and Shinsuke, and third was Despy and Jun Kasai against Masashi Takeda and Rina Yamashita against Matt Tremont and Nick Gage. Were you able to catch any of those matches live?
I saw Blue Panther and Ultimo Guerrero. It was great. Yeah. Yeah. The other ones I haven't seen yet. I actually have links to watch the Hero match and some of the others too, but the Hero match was one that I was, if I got a break, I was going to watch. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to check that out. Shinsuke is going to be a megastar. It's very similar to the Aja Kong match last year, which also got a lot of rave reviews because Shinsuke did a great job selling and, showing a lot of fire. I mean, you know, last year she got a kick out over to the point that her room was going crazy for. It just seems like she's got limitless potential, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that, yeah.
So very excited to see where she goes going forward. Any thoughts you had on what you did go to? Because I know you were making the rounds.
I was just going from show to show. There's nothing super blow away. I thought like an Italian Shayna Baszler at the Bloodsport was kind of cool. Blue Panther and Ultimo Guerrero was excellent. It was really a great match. But, CMLL in Vegas at the Pearl was so different from the CMLL that I see. Not what they did in the ring. That was similar, but just the difference in the crowd. So it was kind of like, I was looking for like an Arena Mexico crowd, and it was nothing, of course, like that in Las Vegas. But, I mean, the guys worked hard, and it was a star-laden show. I mean, they brought the stars. But,
what it really impressed me, and I read about this in the poll results, is that Panther and Ultimo, their ages add up to what, almost 120, if I recall correctly, at this point.
65 and 54, so it's 119. Yeah.
119. Yeah. I thought they worked harder than anyone else all Mania weekend, and it's not saying that like no one else worked hard, but like they were dying in that club. They were not going down without a fight. That attempt to just steal the show. I actually watched a solo match or singles match they had back in January in CMLL down in Mexico, and I thought this one just blew that out of the water in Vegas.
I have seen I think three singles matches with them in the last, I don't know if it's a year or so. I mean, they were all similar. I think that they worked the Vegas match was unbelievable. I mean, yeah. it was the best of all of them. But they're all good in this. They're all like really good. Like they're shockingly good. I mean, there's two that I remember that everybody talked about like the day after that they were, they did it, or at least the people, I mean, it had a lot of talking. I mean, this one was similar to them, but I think one step further, but I mean, it was the best match I've ever seen with people of that age. That's for sure. I mean, Blue Panther is the best over 60 wrestler of all time. There's not even a doubt in my mind of that one. And Ultimo Guerrero is his perfect opponent. I mean, Ultimo Guerrero is just such a great, he's a great worker. You know, I mean, he's like a lot of those guys. They, I mean, they're very underrated in the sense that they're of their ability to make limited people look good. And their timing and where to be and everything like that. I mean, like those guys in, you know, the Technicos that are the top stars in Arena Mexico and in CMLL. It's like they have that group of rudos that are main event rudos. And it's like, I think that they don't get the credit because those guys are just, you got to be in the right place for those flying moves and know how to take them, or it actually looks really bad. And Ultimo Guerrero, you know, even at 54, you know, his positioning and things like that is great. And, you know, he makes everything safer and makes it look good. And it's just, he's amazing too.
Yeah. There was a Blue Panther dive in that Vegas match. Like, I forget if he went off the top to the floor or the apron to the floor, but whatever, at his age, he probably shouldn't be doing that. But frankly, with Ultimo Guerrero there, I mean, he made sure he was perfectly safe. Really impressive stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is that, you know, one false move at that age, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, it's scary.
It's like, it wasn't just like simple dives. I mean, he was doing like, you know, Hurricane Rana's off the apron and things, you know, I mean, it's the stuff that like, it was just like, oh my God, you know, it's like, it's the stuff you expect Rey Mysterio to do 20 years ago.
Yeah. Like adjusting for age, like there are a couple of spots I was like, you know, once you account for age, this is like Darby level, just flinging yourself around stuff. But yeah, I was really impressed by that. I've already gushed about Cinca. I thought, yeah, I know you gave 5 stars to Punk and Reigns. And I do think that was a really good match. I think I went either 4.25 or 4.5. I just did not really flirt with, like, you know, that all-star or all-time classic status for me. But, I mean, it was the best part of what was kind of a doldrummy WrestleMania, I feel like.
I liked night two. Night one I thought was okay, but the commercials just... I mean, it was more the idea of spending so much time on commercials on a $30 a month streaming service that really rubbed me the wrong way. And especially because it was WrestleMania. But I mean, I would have thought that even any show, I would have said the same thing. But the fact it was WrestleMania made it worse because it was like, you have all this talent. And I mean, this is like their big match of the year, right? They've been building the food, you know, in some cases for months, in some cases for weeks. But even so, it's like, this is my match of the year. And then you go there and it's like, you got 7 minutes. And it's just like, you know, 7 minutes is great for, you know, two prelim guys at a house show. You know what I'm saying? I mean, on Raw, those guys at that level wouldn't have gotten 7 minutes. They've gotten like 12 or 13. And the reason they had the time, I mean, you had 3.5 hours for, we had 4 hours the first night, 3.5 hours the second night. You know, for, what was it, 7 matches the first and 6 matches the second, you had plenty of time. But with all those commercials, you know, who got screwed? It was, you know, most of the wrestlers on the show except for the main eventers.
Dave, I kind of want to take this in a little different direction since we're having the conversation about WrestleMania weekend. We know WWE is having their first WrestleMania abroad outside of North America and Saudi Arabia next year. And we got some comments earlier in April from Will Ospreay kind of talking about how AEW should consider taking over WrestleMania weekend because there's a, kind of a gap in where, like, these independent companies aren't going to Saudi Arabia. AEW historically has tried to stay away from WrestleMania weekend to not associate themselves with it. Is there, one, a realistic opportunity for them to really capitalize on it? And two, is that something that Tony Khan's going to be wanting to do considering his history with the weekend itself?
That's a tough question. It's a risk because, you know, what if fans don't travel for it? Then, you know, I mean, it's like they're not going to travel in the numbers that traveled for WWE. So it's not really necessarily worth it for the independent companies. Yes, if you go to, you know, and then what city, you know, I mean, let's just say it's, I don't know, what city would you go to? I think Vegas is probably the wrong city at this point. Mm-hmm. If you say like, well, let's go to Los Angeles, that's a cool city. You know, I mean, there's issues in Los Angeles and with the traffic and everything. And where you would go. I mean, they came, I mean, it was years and years and years ago when they came to San Jose and Santa Clara, and there were a ton of independent shows. I think that was right around the time that the independent stuff in conjunction with Mania really got big. New Orleans would be a nice place, obviously. I mean, Dallas was really good. I mean, as far as like, you know, the number of buildings in the area that were like, you know, we were walking distance from place to place. So that was a pretty cool area. But will people go? And man, it's like, I'll just say it's a risk, because if he goes in there, you know, it's like, it's a gamble. Plus it's WrestleMania weekend in the sense that people will want to, they're going to want to watch their WrestleMania. Mm-hmm. You know, it's probably a bad, you know, like, it'd probably be better to do it like a few weeks earlier or a few weeks later. But if you want to send a message like, hey, you know, you left the country, we're going to, you know, could it work? I mean, it's like, I don't know. It's total. If everybody banded together, could they do something very successful? It's uncharted waters. I don't really have a great answer. I
think they really need a cornerstone event to build off of, and I don't know that they'll have that.
I think one interesting element here is the fact that AEW has been very selective about letting their wrestlers within, like, utilize independent dates. But if you kind of co-opt your own weekend like this, it could be almost, for lack of a better term, an AEW-sponsored event where, hey, the whole idea is you're going to be able to see a lot of AEW wrestlers wrestling the entire weekend. And maybe that could end up being a selling point where, hey, you're not going to get to see every AEW wrestler on the AEW show, but everybody's going to be involved in all these other independent matches and theoretically make them a bigger draw of the entire weekend, where they're not really doing a ton of WrestleMania weekend stuff as it currently sits anymore.
Yeah. I think it's absolutely something that should be studied. But it's a risk. I mean, like, they'll get a certain number of people, but it's like, what does it take to be considered a success? Like, if you you're not going to do two shows, but let's say you do one show and you make it a stadium show, because you almost have to. And let's say you draw 30,000. That's okay. That's okay. Right. And I think that the All in Arlington showed that they can do that. But I don't know, like, WrestleMania weekend. You know, I mean, when they did Arlington, I mean, WWE threw everything at them that weekend and they still did very well. So, I mean, but with the 30,000 people going, or 25,000 or 35,000, if it's that number, how many of them go to indies? And you know, the thing is an AEW audience, I think, per capita, is more likely to go to those indie shows. So maybe it would be all right. I mean, if you had like all of the AEW guys, let's say you had all the stars wrestling on the stadium show, and then you had all the guys, you know, because they have such a deep roster, like you said, and have them wrestle on these different indie shows every single day, you know, I mean, you could give people a lot of unique matches. I mean, it's like the TNA guys obviously would be completely off the board, but you could get, I mean, you could bring up the CMLL crew, the you know, Maple Leaf wrestling crew, the New Japan, you know, and some of the other Japanese companies, Stardom, Tokyo Joshi Pro. It's absolutely worth discussing, but like it's still a risk.
Yeah, and I know that like St. Louis Anarchy just this past week did not draw well at all, like to the point it might have hurt the promotion permanently. And that's always a risk, just even with Mania Week. So I think that's a big point of concern, latching on to anything else. I thought that back when AEW was doing the Texas residency, because they basically had that building for like 3 weeks uninterrupted or whatever it was.
Yeah.
They might have been ahead if they just basically sublet the building on nights they weren't using it to like CMLL. I remember discussing that with Tyler.
It was talked about. I mean, if you remember in the original perspective, there was going to be a CMLL show, I believe, that week during that run.
Yeah, But like, if they had tried to make it like a little mini Mania weekend, like that could have worked out for them. But you know, they didn't go that route. So I don't know. Like, it depends on what Tony Khan's goals would be. I mean, I think that there would be hard to measure, but I think a noticeable PR bump from, you know, saying, all right, we're going to run an event of some sort Mania weekend here in the States. And, you know, making sure it's affordable because they, you know, TKO ain't dropping ticket prices anytime soon. We both know that.
Yeah. I actually think they may have to. I mean, because their UFC advances and their WWE advances are not that strong. And yeah, one of the reasons is the ticket price. I think they may be, I think that for a lot of reasons, you know, economy being what it is, I think they may be forced to. They won't do it. I mean, what they'll probably do is start with the high ticket prices and get the people who are willing to pay it first, and then start dropping it more and more as shows go on, which is essentially what they do anyway.
Yeah, it's definitely what they did for Mania this year too.
Yeah, and they're gonna have to do that across the board, because I mean, I saw like the next show in Madison Square Garden has like, you know, 4,000 advance or some number like that. That was just shocking, you know. So you know, and I think that's a Saturday Night Main Event too. And you know, it's not just a regular show, but I think that it's a risk worth taking, because the one thing is that if it's successful, it's a news story that's probably in a lot of ways going to be covered a lot more than an AEW pay-per-view, and it'll be covered in a positive way, and it'll be, you know, the story that goes out, as long as they don't, you know, bomb at the box office, the story is that, hey, you know, this other group took over, and I mean, it's positive PR for AEW if it's successful. If it's not successful, it's like they tried and they, you know, they got stomped. But I think at worst, it would be mildly successful. But yeah, you know, I mean, it's been done before, not like this, but you know, in the 80s, WCW, or it wasn't even WCW, it was Jim Crockett Promotions, ran, well, once was WCW, it was 88 and 89, but they ran, you know, shows on the same day as WrestleMania, head-to-head on television versus the pay-per-view, and, I mean, the Greensboro was a huge success. New Orleans was not, you know, I mean, it was successful enough that you know, the cable company said no more, never do it again, but, you know, but I just remember, like, in that one, even then, it was like the 88 one, which was very successful as far as TV ratings go, is one of the highest rated non WWE show, you know, and it went head to head with Mania. And but from of course, it's different media now. You know, the media then didn't give them the time of day, you know, even though Ric Flair and Sting, you know, was up in, you know, did like a 7.8 final quarter and all that stuff, you know, and it was like, they got no outside publicity, even on CNN, they covered WrestleMania and they didn't cover the TBS show.
Well, speaking of ratings, boy, the Nielsen ratings, you hear about this, folks? You hear about this? They are just spiraling over at Nielsen headquarters, it feels like, just trying to figure out a way to measure things so that everyone's happy. And I don't think anyone's ever going to be happy with it. And now we're almost on a year now of just like nearly useless data.
I mean, it's just really weird. And, you know, they just had another change and this one looks bad for wrestling, you know? So they had a change in January 26th, which, you know, it was good for wrestling, but not quite as good as it was before. And it's hard to make sense, because these things that should be very minor changes to tweak things better, when it comes to wrestling, for whatever reason, end up being these gigantic changes that make no sense. You know, like you know, you just can't have drops like that or increases like that out of the blue. It's, you know, it's just not, you know, and in the weirdest places, you know, it was like with AEW, it's like, well, they just got killed, but they got taken down greatly in 18-49, but goddamn 50-54, it's like, the number's ridiculously high, you know, and it's
this week's Observer issue. Yeah. Like it's just a ridiculous increase.
Yeah. It's ridiculous increases and ridiculous decreases. Plus, you know, the other thing with the weakness of the ratings is that, again, I mean, how many people are watching that thing on HBO Max? We don't get the number. And that's just, you know, that changes the entire number. So it's like the actual knowledge that we can pick up from the ratings now. I mean, there is stuff you can pick up, but it's not nearly as much as it would have been 2 years ago, where the TV was the only thing that was where you could watch it and you'd get the quarters and things like that. And they had a system that they didn't vary from. So you can kind of really learn a lot. Now it's like, there's stuff you can learn, but there's all these asterisks. It's like, well, what about this? And what about this? And then that back then, when I would get the numbers, they really did all make sense. I mean, there were some variations where sometimes you go like, yeah, that's kind of weird, but overall they made sense. And now, I mean, I could say that, like, you know, they don't make sense. So it's like, and the thing is like, how do you, if you're Tony Khan, how do you evaluate him? It's almost like you kind of take the good number and get happy. And you, when it's a bad number, you try to say it's the system's fault, and you probably learn from crowd reactions at the live show, which is good, but it's not the be all end all either. So it's like, you're, you know, from a marketing standpoint, you know, I mean, like, again, you know, the ratings used to be what you would look at and determine, like, who's over, who's not over and all that. And it's like, there's so many variations that it's not reliable enough, I guess is the best way to put it.
So if you were in that position, if you were in charge for WWE or AEW, and you were charged with, you know, using the data available to you to determine who is a draw and who isn't at this point in time, like, what would you use if that was entirely your job?
I mean, it's hard because I would say, like, merchandise sales, but you know that there's guys who sell lots of merchandise or guys who don't sell a lot of merchandise that actually are over, you know, for various reasons, and that are, you know, should be on top, even if they aren't the greatest merchandise sellers. But you can't really do live shows because the reality is it's the brand and not the main event. Sometimes, like with AEW, I think that if you would announce a match, like on a pay-per-view, if you announce a match, I think it helps if it's the right match and doesn't help if it's the wrong match. Pay-per-view buy rates for AEW, you still have that. For WWE, I mean, it's like, I mean, merchandise is a big thing there. I mean, you do get the Netflix numbers. I don't even know what they get from ESPN. I think they get it though, but the problem with ESPN is it's so limited. But yeah, there's way more numbers than there ever was, and you can probably learn way less from them than ever before in a lot of ways.
It just seems like a real
reliable. They're less reliable than before. Yeah.
And I find that to be a really interesting thing here, Dave, because when you have the conversation about where AEW is from a popularity standpoint, so much of what you've historically based things on are ratings and ticket sales. And yes. I think the interesting part about Darby Allin as champion, we only have a few week sample size, but ticket sales are looking really good. The ratings have been positive. And when you compare to kind of past champions, we really haven't seen a really large spike. So my question for you is, how much of that, this little spike that we're seeing, is due to either Darby Allin, the fact that there's new blood in the title picture for the first time in seemingly forever, or is this just a result of the real goodwill and really good television that AEW has built over like the past 6 to 9 months? It's an interesting discussion point because it's too small of a sample to really know, but we can kind of opine about what that trend looks like.
Well, the show where he won the title, and so that would be, you know, his match was certainly like the key in that one, did pretty well with viewers. It did not do so great with 18 to 49, but did ridiculous with 50 to 54s. What that means, you know, again, we're back to things. In this last week, you know, everything was down for a variety of reasons, you know, and there is playoffs, but they also, you know, like the collision number was the one that really, you know, I looked at that and go, oh my God, this new system is going back to the old system, because that collision number was, you know, they went from 20th place the week before, or the previous, not the week before, but it was 2 weeks before on Saturday. So they were, because the 1 week they were on, the Mania week they were on Thursday. So like the, I believe it's the 11th, I think that's the Saturday, right? They were the 11th, where they were in like 20th place, but then the 25th, which was right after Derby won, they were in 58th place. And it was just like, you don't vary that much when they were similar right. level shows. You know, both were very good wrestling shows without giant matches, but they're the same shows. And like, you know, they probably had tougher competition, but everyone, you know, if you got the NBA playoffs, you know, multiple games in NHL, right? So it was tougher, but it's like, that's the placings. The placings don't matter. Like your placing should be the same. Like your number could be down, but you should still be in 20th place, right? You know, because everybody else has the same competition you do, you know, that's not the NHL and the NBA. So, you know, but that, I think that that's a different, you know, they figured it out. They're doing it differently again. And, but that one kind of looked, and I looked at that one and was just like, oh boy, we're, and that's not Darby's fault or anything. We really, I can't, I mean, I would say this, like, we can't really judge anything on Darby because the system is too, you know, it's too unreliable right now. I mean, like in months or a month or whatever, you know, when there's more of a pattern, you know, perhaps I don't like credit or fault Darby at this point. It's too early.
Yeah. I don't know if he's going to have the title long, because the way they're booking him, it feels like they're going to do the, you know, the fighting champion burns himself out fast story.
They may.
Which they kind of did with, well, on a longer stretch, but with Orange Cassidy with the, what, international championship a couple years ago, I think it was.
Yeah, but he had a long reign, though.
It was a long one, yeah. I just feel like with Darby that they're just like, all right, you're going to go for like 6 or 8 weeks or something and like have killer matches on every Dynamite, and then the story's going to be that you just essentially run out of gas. I guess we'll see, but I don't know. It kind of feels like that's where the booking is trending right now, at least.
I agree. I mean, I certainly am sensing more and more the idea that it might be Ospreay and Omega at All In.
And yeah, I think that seems right.
If that's the case, I don't see, you know, I would probably see it going to, you know, if that's it, I would kind of see the direction of the title going Allen to MJF to Omega, the way he avenges the loss to MJF, and then to Ospreay, you know, who should be the guy at that point, you know. So so yeah, I mean, it limits how long, if you're going in that direction, it kind of limits Darby's length of his reign by a lot. I mean, and then here's the thing, what if, I mean, MJF was doing really well as champion, and but I think that they wanted for probably a year to get the thing on Darby, just because of, you know, I mean, I think that it's just been a story that they've been building and wanting, and he's worked so hard and everything. So it was great moment to do it, but it wasn't the time for a long title reign. And maybe, you know, it could be one of those things like, you guys probably remember the first time Edge won the title in WWF. Yeah. It's like the ratings went way up, but I mean, the plan was like, he's going to be whatever it was, 3 week, 4 week champion. Right. I mean, that was the plan. They didn't change the plan. WrestleMania wasn't that far off, but it opened the door for him to win it many more times. When he won it the first time, he probably was just like, well, we're going to do this Money in the Bank cash, and we don't even know what it is yet, because it was so early in the Money in the Bank game. And, but the ratings were so high that it enabled them. It put him in that position with the Cenas and everything, where you're going to, because they were changing the title a lot more then, where you're going to get multiple title reigns. Whereas before, I think that it was probably, he'll get his one reign, it's 3 weeks, he's Edge, you know what I mean? He's not a top guy. So you can, like, you can be planned for a 3 week run. Harley Race was another one like that, where you do so well in that short run, you know, whether it's 3 weeks or 7 weeks or whatever, that, okay, now when we're booking 2027, 2028, you know, you're big enough to be in that mix again, mm-hmm. rather than just your Jake Hager, right? When he had a run in WWE, yeah. When it was over, there was never going to be a second one.
I want to ask you as well, Dave, about kind of the AEW title picture as a whole. It feels really reinvigorated with Darby, and the MJF run was excellent, but the stipulation with Hangman Page kind of casts an interesting cloud over the entire conversation, because the lead up to Hangman winning both of those titles, there was a lot of interest. There was a lot you could kind of point tangibly to business being good. But then when he had those titles, business really didn't take a step forward in either reign. It just kind of stayed relatively afloat. So from my perspective, I don't really see Hangman Page as this difference-making draw as a champion for AEW. Do you think that kind of hypothesis might have led to Tony Khan deciding, hey, maybe we try this no title stipulation with Hangman Page and kind of see if that can reinvigorate the character?
I don't know. I'm against any stipulation that has a forever tangible part to it, because you never know, especially in a business where, you know, there's lots of injuries and everything like that, and he still is one of the most popular guys. So I was like very negative on that. Mm-hmm. He did pretty decent as a pay-per-view draw though. But I mean, like, you got to remember with the decline, that was during, that September period where they, you know, changed the ratings around. So it's like, it's really hard to compare at that point. I think the house shows really started showing signs of life. Yeah, probably with MJF. I mean, because the house shows, they were struggling at the house shows. They still are, but it is better. You know, and some of that, I think, too, is more and more going to the smaller, like 1,000-seat building is too small in my mind. 1,500 is too small. You can sell it out, but what does it mean? I think that the 3,000 is probably like the, you know, that's probably the perfect size, because you can sell it out or come close and you get that great atmosphere. But on TV, it doesn't look so minor league, like Sacramento to me, with the sellout in Sacramento. To me, like, that was like, what the size of the building and the kind of a crowd that you want for AEWs. And Sacramento, it's about a 4,000 seat building that for AEW television, you would cut to about right at 3. And I thought that it looked great on TV. It sounds great in a smaller building. The wrestlers get that high from the good crowd. Yeah. And it doesn't look like, you know, when they went to the 2300 arena, which I think, you know, it was a great experiment to do, but in hindsight, you know, you look like TNA in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Kind of a follow-up here to the entire conversation, because one of the things when Cody ended up doing that stipulation was, well, we've seen plenty of promotions really go against their stipulations. Will AEW be one of those promotions, or will they keep it? I don't think we really got to find out that answer, because Cody ended up going to WWE. But Fred and I had talked about it at the time, and I think I figured out a potential way for them to get out of it. And I kind of want your opinion on the idea, because I think the only way you might be able to get out of it without actually having people criticize you a lot is kind of do the Will Ospreay long title reign arc with the babyface bravado of the only guy he's never beaten is Hangman Page. Because he's never faced Hangman Page.
I like that idea a lot. It's a way to get out of it, you know. Yeah, yeah. Because it's a tricky one, because the babyface has to go against his word and the promotion has to go against what they advertised as the stipulation, mm-hmm. which was why, you know, that show did such a great pay-per-view number. The reason was because the stipulation was so extreme, and people thought that, like, they really aren't going to have Page lose with the stip. And Page's promos were so strong that listening to him, you go like, he can't lose. But then there's the other part of you where you go like, you know, I know he's not winning it back. So I think that intrigue did help the pay-per-view number, but it put them, you know, kind of put some booking behind the eight ball. Luckily, you know, Ospreay's back and Omega is working more, and Darby, you know, is now at that world champion level and things like that, to where, Page is not, because I think last year Page was absolutely crucial, you know, he was just crucial to that company. And now it's like, you know, he's important and he's part of that top cast and everything like that. But him not headlining the pay-per-view doesn't mean, oh my God, like, pay-per-view numbers are going to struggle without him as the top babyface. So, but yeah, that's a good storyline though. I could see that one. At the same time, it's like that never challenge for the title stipulation. it's not something like, I mean, you kill the stip, but honest to God, I wish they would never do that stip. It didn't work with Cody. I don't think that it really, you know, it did help a buy rate with Paige, but I just thought that like the aftermath, it's like, I don't think that you should be doing a stip that you know you can't live up to. And if they do live up to it, it handicaps booking of Paige a lot because he's a main event. He's a main event world title caliber guy. Mm-hmm. If it was a guy who, let's just say you really never wanted to be in the title picture again, I suppose you could do it. You know, I mean, in the old days, I could see you do it with someone who's is leaving the territory. So let's do it. And then if he comes back to the territory in 5 years, everyone will forget anyway. Mm-hmm. But
I think it worked really well with Tim Storm when he challenged Nick Aldis for the 10 pounds of gold, like what, 6-7 years ago during the peak of power. That made sense because he was kind of aging out and
right.
It was probably time for new blood. But this one felt a little weird from a timing standpoint, which is why I feel like there's some kind of long-term angle in play, which is how I came across the idea of the babyface bravado angle.
Yeah, hope so.
Yeah, but that I mean, with Tyler's idea, I think at, you know, the likely, I don't like it. Not that Tyler has the idea. It's not that I hate Tyler's idea. I hate that they kind of put themselves in the position where that's like the one path to not being like not making AEW or Hangman Page a heel. And not like in a good way. Like Hangman Page obviously has had a good heel run not too long ago, but like I don't think you want to be, you know, the guy just lies about stipulations and undercuts anything that you ever are put in again. I just think that the benefit they're going to get from this paying off is not going to be enough to, you know, justify the risk.
Yeah. I mean, I was against it from the start. I mean, yeah. I was against it with Cody. I mean, with Cody, it felt,
It was a disaster with Cody.
I mean, the one thing with Cody, it didn't work at all. Like it didn't even help the buy rate. They did a bad number. Which was probably just the people, you know, at that time weren't ready for so many AEW pay-per-views. It wasn't established enough yet, even though a lot of people were watching on television. You know, they're far more established now. It's like a regular thing. We watch their pay-per-views. You know, back then they were, you know, the first one was the unique, but they were like, were they the second? They were like the third, right? The full gear?
I think so.
Yeah, whatever it was, but I guess that it wasn't, it wasn't as strong or whatever. Jericho and Cody, and I thought their promos were awesome building up that pay-per-view.
Just good build, yeah.
Yeah, but it just wasn't whatever it was. It wasn't the right mix, you know, as compared to most of the other pay-per-views. And you did that extreme stip. I think that people probably then, honestly, I think people then probably just figured, just bullshit, because that's what they grew up on, stips all being broken. So it's like they do the stip. It's like, it's bullshit. Now with Paige, what I think made it work is the fact that Cody never did challenge for the title.
Yeah. Of course, I think you can draw a line directly from that stipulation to the weirdness of the Cody-verse in AEW. And like,
yeah. Kind of especially
the last year or so, like from the David Otunga feud on, was like just really awkward. All of it was really awkward.
David Otunga, it was the boxer.
No, sorry. I got stuck on the letter O. My bad. but yeah, like that was a disaster of a feud that just did not work at all. And then everything else from Cody and, you know, in his storylines, like it was already kind of weird because he just wasn't associating at all with like the Young Bucks or Kenny Omega, who of course, you know, or Adam Page, you know, the whole Elite coming in thing. But then like it just really kind of spun out of control there. And it's kind of astonishing to look back at that from where he went in that last year with AEW to like instantly walking into WWE and being like their top full-time star.
It was crazy. People thought like that, he's going to go there and be like a mid-carder. And you know, Vince, you know, give Vince credit for that vision. You know, Vince had that storyline of chasing the title your dad never won, and you know, it was a huge success. Yeah. And you know, he went from a guy like in AEW, you know, I mean, he was a star who was pushed, but
he was never the top guy.
You can't compare him to the Cody Rhodes in WWE, even though it's like they didn't even change his character. Same suit and tie, same
everything,
look, same promo, same entrance music. But in WWE, it was just like he was positioned as the guy at a time when they really, I guess the fans, they were probably clamoring for a guy. Plus, it's like, I think he benefited so much in WWE from being the first guy to leave AEW, because those fans were kind of conditioned that AEW is the bad guy and Cody's there. And he came to our team and the storyline connected. And I mean, I'd have never thought that Cody, you know, until it happened, I would have never thought of Cody as being that level of a star. And I always thought he'd be a star, but not that level. It was, you know, because he's, you know, I mean, it's Cody and Roman Reigns and Punk are really, you know, the three biggest stars, I would say, right now. And, you know, and at times Cody was the biggest of the three for at certain points.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that we're, you know, building off of that, I think we're in a really interesting situation with the interplay between AEW and WWE, in that we've had the period where, like, people were going from WWE to AEW for bigger spots. Sometimes it worked out, sometimes it didn't. And then we've had the period where people jumped the other way from AEW to WWE. And initially, I mean, obviously the Cody was the first one, and that was a huge success for them. And now we're in the period where, like, there's been other successes, like CM Punk, obviously. But I mean, I think
he's unique.
Special circumstances for sure. Yeah. I think you can probably say that there's been some middling returns. With Ricky Saints. I thought he would
little early to judge on him, but I know what you're saying. I mean,
he's been a year in NXT as kind of a not mid card, but like secondary main event, like, you know, not really the guy there, which is real. I thought he would have took it by storm, frankly. And I'm not knocking his performance or anything from what I've seen. It just wasn't used that way, which was interesting. I think Blake Monroe. Ryan Bay has definitely not worked out the way you might have thought, given the Tony Storm thing.
Rusev and Aleister Black, to me, are the ones that.
And Ray Phoenix too. Like Ray Phoenix is.
Ray Phoenix, absolutely. Like,
you could have told me he fell into a volcano 6 months ago, and I wouldn't have any reason to not believe you.
Ray Phoenix and Dragon Lee. You know, there's history, and you should learn from history. And some people think history doesn't apply to them, but like Ray Phoenix and Dragon Lee, to me, when they both made those decisions, I thought like,
they're not very WWE performers.
I don't think you understand what they do there and what your strengths are, because it doesn't, it's not really compatible, even though those guys can be awesome. You know, it's like their strength is something other than what WWE has. So you're kind of, but yeah, I thought like when Penta and Phoenix were leaving, it's like, you know, I know your brothers and you want to do it. And I thought like Penta, you know, go, you've got super charisma, you know what I mean? Go, but everyone be smart, you know, Ray Phoenix and he, you know, kind of burned a bridge on the way out too. And it's just like, what are you doing? You're going to be in bad shape there. I mean, not that he was knocking him dead in AEW, but Ray Phoenix was a guy who Tony would put in a 15, 20 minute match with a top guy. He would do great. He could get some wins here and there. He wouldn't be buried, you know, to where he's doing 5 minute matches and only putting people over, you know, Ray Phoenix wasn't the right fit for WWE.
Yeah. He would have been in like the Mike Bailey spot. Mark Briscoe, even like the guy you dial up for like a really great 15 minute, you know, middle dynamite match or a strong collision main event. And he would have been featured regularly. Like Dragon Lee, I mean, at least he's gotten some pushes, like not big ones, but at least like, you know, little buddy of AJ Styles is something, which is more than you can say for Ray Phoenix.
You're right. Yeah, Ray Phoenix hasn't gotten really anything. I mean, he came in and they just
had a little bit, like 2 months, and then they were like, "Oh, wait, we forgot what you were."
Yeah,
you know. Do you think there's any chance Malakai Black goes back to AEW? Because I just feel like that's like there's a big blinking sign that's just like disaster if they do that.
I don't know. It's a disaster, but. I don't know. I mean, I mean, it'd be, if he came in and, I mean, the thing is you'd have to come in and lose a lot, but then if you do that, you're kind of like, well, why bring him back?
What's the value? Yeah.
It's like, I don't know. I haven't talked to Tony about him at all. And, you know, and I don't think he would say anything one way or the other anyway. You know, I don't rule it out, but like if I was in that position, would I do it? But then again, I wouldn't have done Andrade, and Andrade's been a big success. So, you know, it's like you don't know. Of course, you know, Andrade's also a lot better wrestler than Block. Yeah.
And I'm going to steal something from Joe Lanza and Rich Craich on the flagship. This is entirely their things, but I'm so credited. But like their thing is that Andrade is just always unhappy unless he's getting a huge push.
Yeah.
You know, Malakai was kind of uniquely unhappy in AEW as, you know,
he was getting a good push.
Oh, he wasn't jobbing for anyone.
It just felt like he didn't respect the promotion from the outside looking in.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Rusev too. You know, those two to me were very similar in the sense of, I think Punk too, you know, although Punk was a top guy in AEW, I didn't really notice it with Punk until, you know, really that.
The second run?
The interview, you know, the interview that started all the problems.
Oh, yeah.
When he did the line of Adam Page has never done anything in this business, and it's like he's been a world champion in your company that's only had four world champions, whatever the number was at that time, and successful at it, and one of the most popular guys. And it's like, okay, you consider, you know, and I you know, again, people that grow up in a certain way. I'll give you an example. When Roddy Piper, who I talked to a lot when he was in WCW, right? Roddy Piper never respected WCW. Even when WCW was beating WWE, he didn't respect WCW. He respected Jim Crockett. He respected Don Owens, you know, growing up. You know what I mean?
He probably would have died for Don Owens.
Yeah. He was very loyal to Don Owens. But the thing was, is like, in his mind, after he had done this, the world to him was, who's main eventing Madison Square Garden? He'd always say that, you know, ever main event Madison Square Garden. And it's like, you know, your company can't go to Madison Square Garden. It's still winning the war. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But to him, it's like, you know, and I think even like Nash and those guys, I think that like when they were in WCW, I always sense that they thought, well, really, Vince is really the guy, and WWF is really the major league. We're doing good here, but, you know, and it's like, and I sort of sensed Punk like that in the sense that I don't think he really respected AEW in that way. And I think, you know, the guys that I was always, you know, the guys that I would always think would be the guys that, like, I don't know, like, you know, Black did come through the indies, and he did come through it with, you know, guys who, you know, that generation of guys that Black came through it with, most of those guys did respect AEW. But for whatever reason, you know, like, you know, part of it was that he got fired, and then, you know, Levesque got in charge, and he thought, oh, you know, it's like now
all likes me.
That it's all new. And I go there, and then he went there, and it was like, you know, they used him a lot worse. And Rusev was the same, you know, Rusev, I really sense with Rusev that he was fine as long as he was winning. You know what I mean? Yeah. But once he got asked to lose, I think that he wasn't fine. Even though in WWE, all he did was lose. And it was like, I don't know if it was, I don't want to hurt my market value to go back because I think I can go back. And then it just turned into, you know, just a completely negative thing. And then he goes back, and then look what he's done. I mean, it's like, I mean, I would have thought he would have done better just if nothing else to show people that like, hey, you know, you AEW guys come here and you're going to be bigger stars. And instead, like, you know, with Black and with Rusev, it's kind of like the messages is like,
no guarantees.
Yeah. You think the grass is always greener. It's like, it's a risk, you know, might be better. It might not be.
Yeah. And Ray Phoenix too is another good example of that, to get back to that. But yeah, the comparison for me with Malakai Black and Rusev is that Hogan period of TNA when like Booker T and Rob Van Dam got brought in and very much felt like, you know, again, as someone on the outside, I'm not going to pretend I knew what was going on really, but like, it felt like they're just like, all right, I'm cashing a check and I'm here, you know?
I think in TNA, a lot of the guys had that idea.
Yeah. You know, now, I'm not going to say Black and Rusev worked hard when they were on TV, but like the comparison I'm trying to draw is the lack of kind of respect in a way for the company you're working for.
Well, I mean, it was like with Booker T, just an example, right? I always thought Booker T and TNA, it was like, I'm biding time until I go back.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's and he retired like a year later or something, like, you know, so.
Yeah. But I think that that's it. And I think that with them, it was like, okay, I have a job, you know, kind of like Regal. I have a job until I go back. You know, it wasn't like, it wasn't like Danielson came in or Moxley. And it was like their commitment was completely to AEW, even though Danielson could have gone back anytime. And if he was unhappy, he probably would have, but he wasn't. He bonded very well with Tony. Moxley probably was AEW or die. Whereas these other guys, I think it was, okay, I need a job, but the place is WWE. And when you have that attitude, you know, you're not going to be a team player.
Yeah. One other person I wanted to ask you about to completely jump off the U.S. wrestling scene is Aaron Wolf, who I've been kind of fascinated with ever since he debuted in New Japan and has been in this really weird pattern, I guess. Where, you want to talk about that? Like, I could just set it up like that and just let you go.
Well, I mean, he had all that hype for his first match, and, you know, Evil did such a great job. The first match, I thought the first match was a big success. But when I saw it, and everyone's raving, oh my God, this guy's going to be so great. And it was just like, it's really all evil. It's all, it's all evil. And then the next day at the Dash, where, I mean, they were afraid to put him in the ring. And it's like, oh my God, he's worse than I thought from those, because those run-ins were so horrible. You know what I mean? It was like no fire and just, you know, whatever. But he seemed to have fire with evil, but so much of that was evil. So anyway. So then it's just like, man, now, but it's like, he's still a major celebrity and he's an Olympic gold medalist in judo, which is like a real fighting sport. And it's like, then they start, you know, beating him. And it's like, why, you know, it's like, protect him. You know, maybe you can't put him in a 30-minute main event, of course. But so what do you, why don't you just have him win 4-minute matches? You know, he can do that. And the booking, I thought the booking was just atrocious for him. And I mean, now he's just a guy. You know what I mean? He's a guy in the mid card who isn't very good. That's what he is, as opposed to being a superstar who isn't very good. Which we've had a million superstars in wrestling that have been successful that actually weren't very good because they were booked carefully. And even in Japan with the judo guys, you know, it's like, you know, I mean it's a different generation, but Gi-Sink, he was terrible, but he was a star his entire run in All Japan, not having good matches because he was an Olympic gold medalist and because they just didn't beat him. I mean, it is a different world of wrestling now than in the 70s too, though. I mean, in the 70s, it was all about wins and losses and so much. So if you won all your key matches, you were a star. Now it's so much about performance and people don't care as much about wins and losses. So you do have to be better, but you can still protect guys, you know?
Yeah, and especially because they were doing it with the House of Torture, like, that's just a smoke and mirrors act entirely.
Yeah.
I don't understand why they didn't just, like, you know, lean into that with him. But I've heard some rumors that he may not have made a, you know, this is all speculation that I've got, but it may have been a bad impression that he left on people over there. And,
yeah, well, there's something to that for sure. Yeah. But so what? You know, it's like, It wasn't like he made a bad impression, but it wasn't like to throw out CM Punk and AEW. You know what I mean? Where it's something like, okay, we have a problem here. Now what do we do?
He wasn't, you know, grabbing a pair of scissors, you know, stabbing people or anything, you know, like Big Van Vader.
Yeah, he wasn't hurting anything. It was just like, you like a lot of people, you know, it's like you come in and you're a superstar in your sport. I mean, there's guys that try out in WWE that come in and have, you know, issues where, hey, I'm, you know, like, you know, you get a top level football player or something, you know, ever since junior high, you're probably coddled, right? So you go into WWE and oh, hell, I'm a better athlete than any of these guys. Or maybe, you know, a Gable Steveson, you know, is probably the perfect example of this. You know, I mean, I'm so much better at that, but it's a different world and you're not good. And, you know, yeah, you're going to rub people the wrong way. I mean, I think the same thing happened with Steveson, but Steveson, you know, Steve's a different issue. He had his own set of problems.
Yeah. He sucked as a performer and seemingly as a person. So,
yeah. Well, Aaron Wolf, there's similarities there. You know, I don't want to say Aaron Wolf's a terrible person or anything, but, you know,
yeah.
I mean, there's a similarity.
The Aaron Wolf thing a little bit reminds me of when Mystico came into WWE and there were, you know, the reports that he was carrying himself like he was a big deal, which, I mean, he was. He was a massive star in Mexico. Yeah. And they're like, well, that's why you hired him. And they're like, yeah, but he should not act like he's a big star. It's like, I don't know what to tell you guys. You hired someone.
That was a total misfire that, like, you know, before it happened, I knew exactly what would happen. I warned them. I said, like, this is what's going to happen. And it was just like, you know, it's WWE. They don't care about that stuff. It's just like, you know, I mean, it's, you know, and again, you take a guy like this Mystico would be very different than the Mystico then. You know, you're talking about a guy who, so Mystico's 42, right? So his big run was 21 years ago. So he's 21, you know, gets into pro wrestling and or Lucha Libre, you know, probably a teenager. And then at 21, all of a sudden it explodes, right? Right place, right time. I mean, it wasn't like he was great. He was just right place, right time, and explodes for a couple of years. And so that's all he knows. So he goes, Conan was the same way the first time he went to WWE. When, you know, he was just exploded in Mexico and went to WWE. And they, you know, hey, you're not a star, you know. And he would go like, oh, look at what I did in L.A. You know what I mean? And Mystico was just like, you know, all these people, you've never proven anything. And in his mind, it's like, I'm one of the biggest draws in the whole world. You know,
yeah, it was I was pretty casual at that point, but it was just wild to read about that whole situation and see what happened, you know, with him, and how he was used. It just kind of feels like that WWE really wants a Latino star and does not have a great idea of how to do that.
I mean, they want another Rey, and Rey's a big success, but they never. I mean, Rey was unique in the sense they never really got behind Rey. The fans got behind Rey. You know, Rey is like, it was like Jeff Hardy. You know what I mean? It's like they in the office when they had Jeff Hardy, it wasn't like, oh my God, we got this guy and he can appeal to like kids. Let's go all the way with him. It's like, no, the fans said, let's go with him. And it's kind of like, all right, we know he can't be a top guy, but you know, we'll let him. We'll humor the fans, right? And then he still gets over, you know, I mean, like he was more over than Cena at one point, but, and I understand, believe me, I 100% understand why they went with Cena and not him. And they never let him top Cena, even though, you know, his merch and his overall popularity was well ahead at the time. But, they knew Cena wasn't going to be a problem and Jeff was, but, you know, it's you know, it's the same thing. So.
Dave, we want to be respectful of your time, and you've already given us an hour, and we're incredibly appreciative, and this has been a great conversation. But one of the last things I want to talk about is kind of the emergence of Tekla in AEW. One thing it happens all across the realm of sports, per se, where people are really copycat acts. Once you see something, then you try to emulate it. And Tekla's energy is so different from anything that we've really seen in American women's wrestling, because everything about her comes off so authentic. There's no like promo school. There's no acting. It just feels like she is presenting herself like herself. And you can probably equate that to her never really participated in American wrestling before coming to AEW. Do you see this as a potential for younger wrestlers to maybe start to emulate that aspect? And could that in turn be a really nice boom for women's wrestling in general?
Yeah, she's done well. Better than I think anyone expected.
Oh yeah.
But you're right. It's the unique kind of off character. The promos are different. And in the ring, you know, that aggressive thing, I think in AEW more than WWE, I think that the women that get over are the hard-hitting aggressive types. Because again, that's an audience that wants hard hitting wrestling. So she had that going for her. You know, the women that come from, you know, because Stardom's such a hard hitting promotion anyway. I think the women that come from Stardom are way, way, way more apt to transfer positively to AEW than WWE. Because with WWE, you know, I mean, what we've seen, you know, especially like, you know, Julia, just for example, you go to WWE and you know, like, I can't hit people this hard. I have to change my style. So you lose your authenticity. Mm-hmm. Whereas in AEW, you don't have that mentality. It's like, just bring it. We're just like the guys, and we're going to be aggressive. And that's, you know what I mean? Whereas instead of, we need, I'm not trying to say that women need to be feminine, but they don't.
It's a different house style.
It's not about hard hitting. And when you like make your name in a place that's hard hitting, you have to completely change, because you don't want to potato someone and get the rep of being not, you know, not knowing how to work, so to speak. So you tone it down, and then you're not yourself. You know what I mean? I think that that's Blake Monroe, another example. You know what I mean? Like, Blake Monroe was good in AEW, but I mean, the WWE in the ring wrestler, Blake Monroe, is not, you know, is not the same as AEW at all, I didn't think.
I'm willing to chalk up the Mariah May difference to like not being with, you know, partnered with Toni Storm.
That's part of it. Yeah.
I think that's a big part of it. On this note, one thing that caught my eye with the releases last week from WWE is Tamara Mensah-Stock, Tyra Mae Steele, getting released. You know, she, of course, is a former gold medalist in freestyle wrestling. And it just feels like, you know, that's not something WWE is looking for. Do you think there's any chance that, like, if she wanted to, and I don't know if she's going to want to, that's always the question with someone that came straight into, like, the ID program, you know, the WWE ID program, if they're going to continue in wrestling afterwards. But do you think, like, it just, I guess my question is, like, do you just think there's some kind of path that could be developed to reopen the legitimate athlete to pro wrestling pipeline? Because it feels like that's kind of got shut down over the past 20 years. And I think it'd be beneficial to have that open somehow again.
I mean, it's definitely a different mentality. I mean, I see it all the time, like with, you know, even in AEW, you know what I mean? Where, you know, like I always see, you know, Toa Leona, because I've seen the Toa Leona character in the 80s. And I'm not saying he would be a superstar there, but my God, like if Bill Watts or Jim Ross in his prime or whatever was there, they would emphasize the football. They would emphasize the powerlifting. You know what I mean? They would, you know, like a Dr. Death, right? You know, I mean, he wasn't a football player. Dr. Death was not even close, or the wrestler, but powerlifter wise, you know what I mean? He's a really accomplished, super strong guy. And now it's like, I didn't even know about his powerlifting until Danielson in commentary just kind of casually goes, you know, this guy can bench press 600 pounds. It's like, and so I'm listening going like, yeah, bullshit. You know what a 600 pound bench press is? Doug Furness can only do a 600 pound bench press. And he was like one of the strongest men in the world. And I looked it up and it's like, this guy did like a 630 pound bench press. It's like, he's like freaking like Bruno Sammartino, strong and stronger. But we don't even know it because
it's not a feature
anymore. But so as far as Tamara Mensah-Stock, I think, you know, it's up to her. I think if I am her and I want to do pro wrestling and I really want to do it, I absolutely contact Stardom and go like, okay, I'm not going to make a ton of money, but I'm going to get good at this. And that's the place to go to get good. And I think that Stardom would take her as an Olympic gold medalist, because in Japan, you know, that means a lot more in the United States to the fans.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, there's no guarantee she'll make it, but it's probably the place to go. And if she does do well there, obviously it opens the door to AEW, right? So yeah. I think that's if she wants, because going on the indies, she could do it. I don't know that she will. It's not that kind of her improvement wouldn't be as accelerated as just going like, hey, I want to be good at this. I mean, she could go to Mexico and get lots of work if she could break in and they would take her. But I don't know that that style is so conducive and the people she would work with are good enough to where she would have that accelerated learning curve. But everyone I know, every woman wrestler that I know that went to Stardom, you know, always raves about it for the fact that, yeah, you know, like if your level goes up. And I think that that's – so for her, if she wants to do it, that's what she should do, because I don't see her walking into AEW at her level right now. And even with the gold medal, what do you really do with her? Because again, the gold medal doesn't mean as much to this wrestling fan group as it would to 70s wrestling fan. Oh my God, you know, Olympic gold medalist, you know, you'd be a main eventer, you know, just even if you weren't good, if you had that gold medal. And now absolutely, you know, it doesn't mean much at all. It really doesn't.
Yeah, which is wild to think about, but that's where we are as an industry, I guess. Yeah. Dave, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time. Let's get your plugs in for anyone who doesn't know.
Yeah, just WrestlingObserver.com and the Wrestling Observer newsletter comes out every week and go through the, you know, everything that's going on in wrestling. And Fred, I want to thank you so much for all the help that you have done, you know, when it comes to the awards and just looking at stats and everything. It's like it's so helpful. I mean, it's like it really, like for Hall of Fame voting and stuff, man, it's not the be all end all, but it's
no,
like,
it's definitely not.
But it's like in a super, to me, it's a super important tool, because the one thing is that, you know, as you go through different stages of life, your perspective changes. And in a lot of ways, for a lot of people, and me included, and it's what I always fight against, is the perspective of, you know, nostalgia is so high. And so it's like a guy, like as far as like Hall of Fame voting, right? Like there will be people who will want the 50th best wrestler of their childhood ahead of the third or fourth best wrestler of their adulthood. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's like, oh, that's when it was real. You know, when you first start watching, that's when it was real. You know, Kevin Sullivan used to always tell me that. That's when it was real. But you know, it's like I have the perspective of knowing that when I started watching the old, because I sat in the second row and the first row people, all they did was talk about, oh, this stuff is so garbage, you know, but they were there every week. But it's like the real wrestlers were Luthez and Leo Nomolini, right? And while I'm watching, you know, Ray Stevens and Pat Patterson, who are freaking awesome, going like, you know, I don't have anything to compare them with, but they're great. But they're, you know, and it's like, and it's the same thing every generation, you know, it's like nobody can, now we're at the nobody can be better than Shawn Michaels era. And it's like, you know, it's really not that way. Nothing against Shawn Michaels. I mean, he was, anyone who's great in their era is great, right? Even if it doesn't look great on tapes watching now, you were great in your era in some way, shape or form, then you're great. But what the thing is like, with the research that you do, it's like, I can look and go like, this guy was like top in this era way more than this guy in another era, you know? You know, like there'll be people who will like go like, oh, the Young Bucks, hey, they're no good, right? And I'll look and I'll go like, you know, like forget about the matches, throw that out. It's like dominant in your era. You know what I mean? It's like nobody had tag team longevity except for the Briscoes and maybe, you know, when Mark and Jay, and maybe Dory Terry Funk, you know, because
Rock and Roll Express, maybe
not the Rock and Rolls, but the Midnight Express. Did.
But they were only a few years. Midnight Express, really?
Yeah, well, they two different forms, I guess. So they were like 4 or 5 years, and they were the Young Bucks are special because they just it's been but completely like 20 years
or 40 yeah years. Yeah yeah. I mean, like, there's no, you know, when you think about that, it's like yeah, they have longevity, but people will think of like the Road Warriors. Now they had longevity, and it's like Road Warriors were super hot. I mean, they were super hot for a couple of years, and they were around after, but I mean, if you talk about like,
they disappeared a lot.
Yeah. Animal was out for a long, long time. And then when they did their comeback, I mean, really, they weren't very good when they did their comeback. No. Yeah.
Like nineties, Road Warriors had some moments, but it was definitely not what the 80s was. Yeah, you're getting dangerously close to encouraging a Sin Lamite situation here, Dave, because that is the dream for me to just do like a 3-hour podcast with you. But yeah, like I'm working on my, you know, it's greatest wrestler ever, 100 greatest wrestlers ever.
Oh man, that's brutal.
I'm working on my ballot right now, and like this is what I'm going through, and I know I have these massive blind spots of like pre-2017 Joshi, you know, I don't know super well. Dragon Gate, outside of like the past 3 or 4 years, I don't know great. Shoot Style is not a area I've watched very much of at all, and I'm just like, even with what I do know, it's like, all right, so do I put like, where do I put Mark Briscoe in comparison to Akira Hokuto? Like it's kind of
I put here Akira Hokuto higher, but I don't know.
Yeah, I've watched probably 5 Akira Hokuto matches in my life, and 4 of them were this week. And so it's kind of hard to just like put in that context. And, you know, it's, but, you know, nostalgia is a hell of a drug, and that's always going to be a problem with any kind of, now versus then comparison. You know, you kind of have that with, basketball, with people who, you know, grew up with Kobe Bryant as the big star, even though he was never the best player in the NBA when you really look at it, are like, oh, LeBron's not as good as Kobe. And it's, you know, if you try to look at it objectively, it's a completely insane take, but like the marketing machine was there for Kobe, and then you have Kobe's tragic death and all this. And it's a really, you know, like I grew up, Owen Hart was my favorite wrestler when I was growing up, when I was a kid. And obviously I stopped watching for a few years, mainly because he died. And so now I'm looking at this list, like, you know, how do I fairly rank Owen Hart? You know, who, you know, even when you watch him now, obviously sticks out as a fantastic performer, but like, you know, what is that compared to Tam Nakano or Hiroki Goto? Like, this is really,
that's hard.
You know, it's kind of a silly exercise, but, you know, I do say that lists make my brain release the good chemicals, so it's just kind of fun at the same time. So, and when it comes to the win shares for the Observer Awards, like, you know, I think it's a great tool to kind of get an idea of how to, like, it's not, like you said, it's not the end-all be-all. I would never present it like that, but I think it's a great way of looking at, like, you know, I think there's some people that are still stuck in, like, with Will Ospreay as an example, like, they're still stuck with, oh, I watched the highly synchronized Ricochet GIF once, and that was it. I made my mind up. Yeah, and, you know, if you watch him now, you know, he still gets votes in High Flyer, but it's like he's not the best High Flyer because he's really not a High Flyer anymore. He's a bruiser.
Yeah,
you know, he looks more like a guy that beats the shit out of people than the guy that flies around to try to win.
But the thing with him, he's a much better pro wrestler now, but because I think
he's so much better.
The thing is that he has a certain series of athletic gifts, body control and explosiveness that are just uncanny that make him stand out. It was like when I first saw, like, I just remember being a kid with Satoru Sayama, and I would tell him, oh my God, like, you know, this guy's the fastest guy I've ever seen. And they would go like, oh, you know, we watch Jerry Estrada. He moves in the ring really fast. And it's like, no, you don't understand.
There's levels to this.
You don't understand. It's like, oh, fast. Yeah, we watch wrestlers who move fast. And it's like, no, you don't. You know,
Thing I can really, as far as Ospreay's speed, Masato Yoshino, I think, I've seen from him, and like Rey Mysterio, and that's it. Like, that's more or less the list that I can think of. Maybe I don't even think like Starlight Kid, who I think is a pretty fast worker. Maybe some other Dragon Gate guys I'm not thinking of right now, but yeah, it's
Bron Breakker and Callum Newman are for their size really fast.
Oh yeah, I don't know if that's more explosive or fast, but like, yeah, Bron Breakker special. I fought for him to get on the FSM 50 the year before last because he didn't do much last year, but the year before I was like, this guy's probably worthy of like a 35 to 50 spot, guys. Like, he's putting on really good matches, and it's not a company that, you know, cares about match quality. But he is a hell of a worker at a young age. And I didn't win that argument. You know, that happens sometimes. But I mean, you know, if they don't mess him up, or if he doesn't just like decide, hey, I don't have to have good matches, you know, then I think that he could really be like a long-term special guy. As I'm completely just, you know, stream of consciousness right now. But yeah, like another one from the wind shares, and then I will try to, you know, let Tyler be nice and let you go. this is the danger with me. I think Jon Moxley, when you look at it, really benefits from it. And I think I've been voting for Moxley for a couple years now. But I think we're getting to the point, like, if we're not at it, we're really close, where as a performer, I wouldn't say as a draw. I think he's not bad as a draw. Like, he has some Hall of Fame points there as a draw. But I think as a worker, he is almost to the point where I think it's just undeniable. Because you have basically the entire AEW run. You have the Shield run in WWE. And, you know, with some indie work you can point to if you want to, some post-Shield work stuff in WWE you can point to. But I mean, like, just from day one in AEW, he has been like an all-world performer. And we're at 7 years of that now. He's probably saved AEW, like, if not outright, like, really kept them from going into freefall like twice now. The pandemic and then after Punk. And I think that he is an obvious, I think he's clearly in, but like, you know, I'm possibly higher on him than others. I think this is the year where, like, you have to get serious about Jon Moxley as a Hall of Fame candidate.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
100%.
Okay, I'm going to shut the hell up so Dave can go and do other stuff.
Yeah, before we go, Dave, I just want to say thank you. It's you've been incredibly gracious with your time over the past couple of years with us. And being I cover the NFL for a living and have for 4 years, and you don't meet a lot of people with the kind of reputation and stature like yourself who are willing to dedicate this kind of time. And I just want to say thank you. And it's very appreciative considering, you know, in my specific line of journalism, how many times you get shot down and just overlooked and like kind of ignored. And giving us this time is it's kind of special. And I just want to say really professionally, personally, thank you.
Yeah. And I really appreciate it too, because mainly I'm just a dipshit with Excel.
I've learned so much perspective from that stuff, you know, like, you
know, I mean, that's really kind of you to say,
when you look at like one of the things also, like, I should stop too, but like, you know, when we talk about like big draws,
we can tell Tyler to hit the bricks and we can keep going if you want, man. Like I got a clear afternoon.
Yeah. No, I don't though. I've got to do
okay. Well, you got to go then.
Okay.
Right. But go ahead. You're saying, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but it's like when it comes to like drawing and people like, oh, like this guy or whatever. It's like, if you look at like there's certain dominant guys in every generation, right? But it's like, you know, some have longevity and some don't. And the ones with longevity, it's kind of like they're special, they're rare. But Hulk Hogan wasn't the first one either. We did for today for this month's argument, but. But he's one of them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
yeah. It's like, you know, he's, but it's like, I think that was what was so interesting to me when I started studying the drawing was Londos, because it was like, goddamn, 21 years is like a top draw. And then, you know, he pretty much retired, but when he would do his comebacks, he still drew, you know, and it's like, that's a special draw.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, on that note, Dave, we're going to let you go. Thank you again so much for your time. We really appreciate it. And thanks to everyone for listening. On behalf of Tyler, I'm Fred. This was Dave Meltzer on it with us on The Good, the Bad, and the Hungy. Everyone have a great week. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay.
Hello. Do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.